Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Indeed. And joining us in the studio today, it is The Times' very own Alison Rudd. Coming up, we'll look back on an historic afternoon for VAR at Selhurst Park and discuss life without Kane for Tottenham. But first to Anfield. The front page of the game today reads teenage kicks as 18-year-old Curtis Jones settles the Merseyside derby with a stunning goal to send Liverpool through to the fourth round of the FA Cup. He becomes the youngest scorer in a Merseyside derby since Robbie Fowler in March 1994. And after the game, Jones talked about his frustrations of being in and out of this all-conquering Liverpool side, despite his very young age. Alison, what do we make of Curtis Jones then and his performance?
What I like most, and there's a long list of things I like, but what I like most was his attitude. Mm. You sort of expect, these stories are not unknown, that teams have to rotate or maybe have injury crises, and in the cup it happens all the time. You see players you've not seen before for your clubs, they come through. And it's you know, for all that people moan about the FA Cup not being taken seriously, it is a chance to see who might be the starlets of your club. And normally, if they play reasonably well or even score, there's a sort of level of gratitude and please they took their chance, and there's a sort of humility. And Curtis was, he was just so honest about how it had felt waiting for the opportunity to shine, and he let you know he knew he could do it. He was telling the world this was no fluke. I have been chomping at the bit. I've been letting people know politely, I am ready. It's been frustrating knowing I'm good enough. I can go out there and do it. And I got a real picture of how it must be to be an academy graduate or a young player at Anfield at the moment, that you're all taught what the system is, what's expected of you. You know you're part of a team that's doing wonderful things, so you're going to have to be very patient. But as long as you take on board every single principle, and that's what they did to a player. They played like proper good imitations of the real thing. They were pressing and harrying and focused. You can do all that and you can still have the confidence to show off your ability with that beautiful finish, I just think that speaks volumes for what Klopp has built at the club. It's all very well saying, oh, they might go on to have a dynasty and Klopp could rival Shankly or Paisley in the affections of Liverpool fans. But we don't know, do we? But then you see something like that and you think, golly, it's trickled right the way through the team. I was so impressed.
Gregor, do you echo those sentiments?
Yeah, I mean, it's the confidence that stands out the most, and he wasn't alone in that either. I thought Nico Williams, the right back, was fantastic. He's so dynamic. The crosses he was whipping into the box, like, and he had a great strike in the first half as well. Stung Pickford's hands with it, and Harvey Elliott. He's only 16, and he's, although they've brought him in from Fulham, he's obviously got a bit of swagger about him too. You see when he was coming off the pitch and he gave Klopp a wink. He's like, yeah, I did all right there, thanks. And you could see Klopp kind of just smiling, kind of look at him going, wow. You know, I think he was even blown away a little bit by the kind of...
He sounded it,
you'll
didn't
see,
he? Yeah.
You'll see them in training every day and you'll know their ability and they'll know it. That's where his confidence comes from. He's training with them every day And he's obviously thinking, well, yeah, I'm playing with some of the best players in the world here. I'm not. I don't feel out of place. So that's why. That's where his confidence comes from. But you could see even Klopp was kind of thinking, yeah, we've got some stars of the future here.
And that is what is so exciting for Liverpool fans, I guess, Alison, knowing and seeing the products that are coming through more and more.
Yeah, I think it was also a bit of a surprise because of what happened when Klopp played an utterly B team when he was off winning the Club World Cup. And Klopp wasn't there to oversee the youngsters he left behind to play against Villa. So you sort of thought, well, could the same thing happen? You look at the Everton team, it is as strong as it could be. On paper, it did look like there might be some element of a repeat performance of this is what happens when Liverpool are focused on something else. You know, I suspect a lot of people there at Anfield were surprised at just how well it turned out. I think we must not forget Everton, although there was equal possession in the first half, Everton did create quite a lot of chances. It was more the second half that you could say it worked properly. It could have gone badly wrong, couldn't it, if Everton had taken some of their really good chances. But it almost, like, a lot of the cup stories feel like they're scripted to me. You know, why was I at Crystal Palace? Because you kind of think, well, bearing everything in mind, there's probably going to be an upset there. Why do the cameras go to a certain place? You weigh it all up. You think there's going to be an upset. It did feel like it might be a step too far to expect a lot of changed players, a lot of youngsters to cope with a full-strength Everton team under a new manager. And the fact that they withstood the early pressure from Everton and then found their stride and became better as the game went on is really quite remarkable. Very heartening.
I think as well that obviously a lot of focus has been on the young players, but someone like Adam Lallana, who, you know, I've thought his career at Liverpool is really over. He's had a long time out with injury and he's come back. He's been really important player for them recently. And Keita came in, and I know he's injured again. He's been brilliant. Ox came back to full fitness. They have got a really pretty formidable squad. You know, we talked about all these games they've had over the last month or 6 weeks. They've just come through. They've just sailed through it, really. So, yeah, I mean, people, you can quickly think at this sort of time, yeah, this could be a dynasty. But the main thing, there's so much love towards Liverpool just now and how they're doing everything right in recruitment and, you know, the academy, as we've seen. But it's all because of Klopp and his personality. There's no team in European football who reflects the man in the dugout quite in the same way as Liverpool.
Just a final point then on these youngsters, and maybe it is down, or Alison, maybe you can tell me, is it down to Everton's disappointing second half performance that Liverpool players came to the fore in the end? How did they, those youngsters in particular, not crumble in what was a huge game?
Well, I have to echo Gregor. It will have been a remarkable half-time team talk where Klopp would have told them all the reasons why they had the edge over Everton, including the fact they were, what, on average 5 years younger?
Yeah.
And they looked it. They exploited that pace, that freshness. As a team, they looked really fast and at it, mentally quicker, more alert. And I think that probably blew away Everton. They might have been expected. They probably had a team talk that was more about your class will shine through. They're going to be a bit, you know, a bit disappointed with how they've conceded those chances. And it was just the marrying of those two effects probably was the crux of it. Is if you've got what looks like a negative, which is inexperience, and you can turn that into the positive, you're away, aren't you? And I suspect that's what Klopp did.
Mm. There was a negative, though, to that game, and that is the injury for James Milner, forced to limp off just 9 minutes into that third round clash. And it leaves Klopp with little options at left back, as although first choice Andy Robertson is available, there is no recognised backup. Such is the lack of options to fill in at left back. Milner was replaced by the 19-year-old Yasser Larucci, who made his Reds debut in the Merseyside derby then. And the Reds headed into the game welcoming the likes of Brewster and Oxlade-Chamberlain back into the fold. But Milner's setback is set to leave the runaway Premier League leaders with up to 7 players sidelined. Should Liverpool fans then be concerned at the number of injuries, Alison?
Well, you have to be on the one hand. But We've just been waxing lyrical about depth yes. they've got. So I don't think the crisis is going to be so bad that Klopp feels he has to make as many changes as he did to the FA Cup in the league ever. He's the other I don't want this to sound like we're just turning him into some sort of deity, but the other thing that Klopp is very good at is juggling positions on the pitch. The way he's turned James Milner into Superman. He can play anywhere. And that I don't think James Milner would have played anywhere under anybody else, because it's just the way Klopp tells players they can do that. His enthusiasm is infectious. If he told me I could speak French, I can't. But if Klopp told me I could, I think I would. I think I'd be able to do it.
It would just come to you.
You're going to make a good
goal. It would just, my brain, that little part of my brain that thinks it might have known French when I was 11 would spring into action and I'd be able to do it. So I'm not, I'll miss James Milner and hope he's back soon, because it's not just the way he plays. I just think he's a fantastic influence on the team. There's something about, even when he's just on the bench, knowing it's sort of like with Milner, you know, it doesn't matter what position you're light on, James Milner can fill it. But I do feel that approach can work with whoever he's got left for Klopp. If he has to make a real emergency substitution at fullback one day, whoever he puts there will feel they can do it extremely well, and that means they will.
Well, I read that Larucci actually arrived as a right winger, so he's transferred.
He's already done it. He's already done it.
That does sum up Jurgen Klopp, doesn't it? Well, Henry Winter was at Anfield, and in the game today, he writes, Klopp's Colts highlight gulf facing Ancelotti, goes on to remind Everton fans of Bill Shankly's infamous words that there are only two teams on Merseyside, Liverpool and Liverpool's reserves. Maybe a touch harsh on Everton, but Gregor, how much of an opportunity missed was this for Carlo Ancelotti's side?
Well, yeah, obviously a major opportunity, because they'll never face... very unlikely to face a more weakened Liverpool side. But I think Ancelotti even said afterwards, the team that Liverpool put out, it wouldn't have affected the way he approached the game. And he's one manager who's actually gotten beyond Klopp when he was manager of Napoli in the last year or so. I think they would go and set up in the same way and be fairly sort of conservative in their approach and look to hit them on the break. Because, as was said, Liverpool, no matter who they put out, they know the principles of play. They hunt in packs and try and play out of pressure. So I think it just highlighted that Everton they've signed so many players who've disappointed, really. And, you know, they've spent so much money, and it's been done in a fairly sort of cack-handed way, I think. You know, people were, at half-time, people were saying Theo Walcott had been a real danger down the right. In the second half, he was absolutely woeful. And that kind of, that was like his career in a microcosm. I don't know why anyone's surprised. He's 30 years old and he's been swinging from being looking like someone who should be playing for England to someone who shouldn't be on a pitch in a Premier League team. Gylfi Sigurdsson, you know, he cost as much as Liverpool's entire starting 11, and he's been a flop. I think we can say that now. He's been.
No, I wouldn't go that far.
I think he's been a flop. And Schneiderlin. Schneiderlin's another one. I think there's just too many people who have spent a lot of money on it, kind of getting towards their 30s, or you know, it's probably the last big contract. And, you know, there's just an incoherent approach to the way Everton has been run a long time. But that might be changing now, and Ancelotti's obviously a good manager, and he'll look to remedy that in January. He said that after the match, we've got to sign some players. So I think it probably just showed where Everton are, really.
I mean, you're right, he did say after the match that they're going to have to dip into the transfer market, but where on earth do they start by strengthening and changing this side, Alison?
Well, it's... They do have some good players.
Those people are just named good players.
Exactly, you just named some really good players, and I think the reason it's not working is...
their
they've
best
been
in
bought.
The past.
Well, partly, maybe. Yes, partly. But also, they've been bought with a view to them individually solving a problem, as opposed to them being bought to fit into a system and a strong philosophy. And Gylfi Sigurdsson, I'll pick on him because I'm a huge admirer of his. He's not been used properly, and he's in the wrong sort of team at the moment. And you pay that much money for a player like that who can be match winning on a regular basis, single-handedly save Swansea from relegation. I won't have that argued with. He did. And he's when he's playing well, he's superbly elegant. And even against Liverpool on Sunday, some of the balls he delivered were inch perfect and just not finished. And then he drifts out of the match. But if you buy him knowing what you want from him properly, and I think you should build a team around him.
So how do you get the best out of him?
You build Sigurdsson. A team around Gylfi Sigurdsson.
Right.
What's the point of spending 50 million quid on a player who is elegant and has the eye for the perfect ball and the added bonus of covering a lot of ground? He's not one of those people who sort of sits back and gazes at his pass and thinks, wasn't that lovely? He really does track around the pitch. He ran more than regularly, had the top stats in the Premier League when he was at Swansea for ground covered. So he's like the perfect Premier League player. But they have not at Everton ever played him like that. They've never. It's as if Everton feel they're too big a club to think they need a Gylfi Sigurdsson to build a team around, because they saw that that's what happened at Swansea and they're not relegation candidates. So why would we do that? There's no embarrassment in being a club that aims to be a top six club, thinking, aren't we lucky? We've got Gylfi Sigurdsson. Let's build it around him. And it's not built around him. He's meant to slot in to a rather haphazard system at Everton. It's been haphazard for quite a long time. And Ancelotti is a good manager, and I hope he does sort it out. But the idea that he would now want to sideline players like Sigurdsson and then buy in more quality doesn't make any sense at all. Work out the qualities of what you've got and make the system work for it.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wayne Rooney helped Derby cause an upset at Crystal Palace to reach the FA Cup fourth round on an afternoon where, guess what? The pitch side monitor was used for the first time in England this season. The referee, Michael Oliver, watched a replay of an incident between Luka Milivojevic and Tom Huddleston and overruled his original decision of a yellow card to send off the Palace man midway through the second half. So a few small steps for Michael Oliver, but surely one giant leap for VAR. Alison, you were there. It's massive, isn't it? You're not sure.
No, well, in isolation, it worked because I have to admit it worked, because one of my many gripes against VAR is the referee on the pitch has the feel, smells, pace, vibe of a match, and he's best placed to know if something is a red card offence or not. So if the referee, in this case Michael Oliver, generally considered a very good referee, feels that he saw it a certain way and there's someone in his ear saying, we think you might have missed something, but you might decide that it was nothing given the context, or maybe our angle's just slightly weird. I mean, you were there, Michael.
But that didn't happen.
What's he going to do? It makes perfect sense for him to think, well, if they're telling me I might have missed something, I am here. I am aware of how that whole thing unfolded. I will go and look at it again. I want to be in control of what happens here. I don't want someone in a studio telling me I should send someone off, because I've got a chance to see for myself what I might have missed. I like the fact that Michael Oliver wanted to take control of it eventually, and that he did go to the monitor. And I disagree with what he saw. If I'd been him, I'd have thought, really? I think I probably got it right, booking them both. It was all a bit pathetic. But he decided there was a movement towards a headbutt. That was enough for him. So he sent Luca off. But I do think that feels more real in terms of assistance in replays than that red card being delivered by a disembodied voice miles away. You disagree, I can tell.
I think you just kind of proved the virtue of it, in that it's a subjective decision, and it's much better. It feels much better that the man who's refereeing the pitch, who's standing in the middle of the game, is the man who takes that rather than some distant body. So, mm-hmm. You know, I've said many times, VAR sort of opens up a whole new layer of subjectivity. But I feel that when decisions are like that and they're subjective, that it feels a lot better for the fans in the stadium. Although, as I mentioned earlier, there was some guy running across in the background, ready to abuse him for coming, just looking at the screen. You could see that on TV on the highlights. But I just feel that that's a lot. That feels a lot kind of better. And I think everyone is more willing to accept that the referee, who would have been taking the decision without VAR, if VAR wasn't in existence, he's the same person who's taking this decision. So I think it's a good thing, and it has to be done more.
And I get that, and I think it is right that they should use the monitors, but I do sort of understand as well where, Alison, you're coming from with that, with the thought that if a referee's in their ear being told, you might want to look at this, they're going, their own thoughts are going to be persuaded maybe differently.
I don't think that happened. I don't think he was told. I don't think there was anyone in his ear saying, you should take a look at this. I think he took it upon himself to go and look at it.
No, there was a very, very long VAR review where Michael Oliver was stood in the middle of the pitch doing nothing.
Yeah,
while someone...
But they didn't direct him to go and look at the screen.
It's his decision.
So that's important,
though.
It's
his decision. That decision is made because, as far as I'm aware, there was a long delay whilst... Because you do look at a possible red card offence is what comes up on the screen. Possible red card check. So there was already a very long wait while David Coote in Stockley Park replayed and replayed. And it was quite a long tussle. Quite a lot of things went on. For a long time, most people in the stadium assumed the red card was because Milivojevic kicked out at Huddleston. Well, he did, but that isn't why he got the red card.
No.
Michael Oliver said later to Roy Hodgson, I gave it for the move towards a headbutt. And that phrase in itself means there wasn't actually a headbutt. It was a move towards a headbutt. And we've seen them not given as red cards as well. It's about interpretation. That's fine. But it wasn't totally down to Michael Oliver instantly thinking, I need to see that again, I'll go straight to the monitor. And maybe this will be refined if they're going to decide to use the monitor more often. Because the irony in all this is we're talking about it because it's the first time it's been used this season, mainly because the Premier League were really worried that if referees started to rely on monitors, it would hold the game up and make the product less exciting. So they've been encouraged to not use the monitors. Then we had the backlash from players, managers, fans, the media, saying, why aren't they using the monitors? They're getting things wrong. Why don't they use the monitors? And so they felt, I suspect, there was a general mood put out. If you feel during the FA Cup, if there's VAR at your ground, if you feel it's an appropriate time to use the monitor, this might be a good weekend to do it. So that's what happened. He thought, this is a very good opportunity for me to do it. But it's It all took much, much, much longer than it had he decided on the spot. I'm not 100% sure I've got this right. I'm going to go to the monitor, because it was a very busy, complicated series of mini fouls going on. And maybe someone in his ear would have said, that looks quite complicated, Michael. Maybe you want to have another look at that. And then he could have run to the monitor and we'd have shaved off 4.5 minutes. If he'd done it like that. But I think that takes season after season of refinement for a referee and the guy in the studio to work in that partnership to get that time down.
Well, you mentioned Roy Hodgson. He obviously wasn't happy with what happened in the game. This is what he had to say on Michael Oliver's decision.
I thought it was a harsh one. I mean, I don't think there was a definite headbutt. I can't perhaps deny that Luger's head moves in Tom Huddleston's direction, but Tom, I don't think, receives any blows or he didn't make anything of it at all, really. He didn't sort of go down and suggest he'd been headbutted, which is to his credit. But, of course, it all depends upon letters of the law and how you want to interpret them, and referees are entitled to interpret the letter of the law, and as a result, the referees explained to me that that's why he sent him off.
So that's what you confirmed to us, Alison, that he was sent off for the intent of headbutting.
Yes, exactly. And that's a separate issue, whether you feel intent to headbutt is a sendable, offable offence, and how do you know he's not just squaring up? I wouldn't have sent him off. But Roy also said, make your minds up, everybody. Do you want the referee to be in charge? Do you want Stockley Park to be in charge? He was a bit cross about there being two ways for his player to be punished, if you like. That, you know, what you've got, first of all, you've got the referee deciding it's a yellow card offence. Then you've got Stockley Park deciding that might not be right. And then you've got the referee's ability to look at it again on a replay. Roy's point, but he was cross, and maybe a few hours later he wouldn't have said it, but Roy's point was, what's the point of having Stockley Park if the referee is going to look at it again anyway? Make your mind up, he was saying.
I think we just need to know what the instances are in which a referee will go to the monitor. So a red card or serious foul play, penalty kicks. I'm not sure what else there is really to go for. Offsides at the moment, although we're not happy with it, is not a subjective thing, so there's no point in him doing that. So when it's worthwhile, and if there's a chance he's missed something, or it's a very marginal decision, then it's good having the referee use it at the stadium and could take ownership of it, and somebody that the fans and everyone else watching knows made the decision.
Absolutely, because also it means there's some consistency within the 90 minutes, because if a referee is refereeing a game in a certain style, and they're not robots and they do have a style, so some referees do try really hard to keep the game flowing and hope that they can manage the game through chatting to the players and saying, look, I'm letting this go, but can we not do that again and not show too many cards, and they don't want to give away too many kicks. If there's an incident and the guy at Stockley Park is taking a completely different approach to the match, it's out of kilter with what we've seen. And it means the player who committed the offence, he's almost jumping into a virtual reality where he's not playing in the same match anymore. He's committed a foul that he feels is in the rhythm of the match, and the referee's been playing it in a certain way. And okay, you could say that's a bit cynical of him if he thinks he can get away with a bit more because of the referee, but that's the way it goes.
But he's been refereed twice.
He's being refereed by someone else suddenly, and he hasn't been able to play that referee. Mm. So it makes much more sense for the referee, if he's going to send someone off, to look at the monitor, because then he's still him. He's still applying, you hope, it's hard to, but you hope he's still applying his own manner of refereeing during the previous minutes.
Well, as we saw at Selhurst Park, VAR is in use in this season's FA Cup, but only at Premier League grounds where the technology is in place. Some fans believe that it's not fair, that it's a competition for everyone, so it should be the same rules applied across all grounds. Where do we all stand on that? Should we be using VAR if not every stadium has it?
Of course not. Ridiculous. Mm.
I think Gregor's going to argue differently.
In what way is it fair that Tranmere had Mike Dean's a big Tranmere fan, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he went to the club and gave them a special two talks on how to handle VAR to prepare them for it. This tells you two things. One, that a club suddenly entering a game where there's VAR and they haven't had it before are at a disadvantage when they're playing a team that has had it. Because if you remember when VAR was first introduced, a lot of managers were saying, we're having to get used to how we tell the players how to play with it and how to cope when there's a delay and how to respond psychologically to the disappointment of when you've just celebrated a goal and then you find that you had no idea at all it was going to be chalked off. And they've had to address the whole way you absorb VAR into how you run a football team. And if you're having to do that just suddenly in one of the biggest games you'll play all season, because it's the FA Cup if you're the lower division side that never has had VAR before, why, you're already disadvantaged because you've got, you know, you're smaller and you have a smaller budget and you've got a rubbishy manager. You've got no experience with VAR as well. That just really does stop a giant killing, doesn't it? So Tranmere, aware of this, let Mike Dean explain, these are the things you look out for. Don't get distracted by this. You know, don't look at the flag. Just letting them know how different it would be, great for Tranmere, but what about the teams who had nobody to come in and give them a chat about what to do?
That didn't affect the decision to award a penalty, which went in their favour. So, I think it's hard, this, because it does feel, you know, if decisions go a certain way against a little team, then they're going to be an uproar. Whereas it went in favour for Tranmere when they got the replay and they're going to make some money. So it does feel a little bit like if the technology is there, and we're not happy with the technology in its current form, but we know it's not going away and it's going to improve over time. So if the technology is there and we're just not going to use it when it's available, because every game in itself is its own entity. It's not like it being in one ground and not being in another is affecting the other ground. It's just if you have the technology and that, and you're able to use it, then why not use it?
But there will be some teams possibly that could argue, well, we've had decisions we could have argued could have gone in our favour if we'd had VAR, so we could be in the fourth round, but we don't have it. And therefore, what for me, it comes across as a very elitist attitude, because it's those teams that can afford to have VAR.
Is a waste.
Well, it is. Of course it is. We know that, unfortunately.
We're going to go on to talk about what the future of the FA Cup, and that'll be based around a handful of teams.
And you're absolutely right. But to me, it does stink of elitism, because all it is saying, well, you've been able to implement or introduce VAR into your ground, because we've had X, Y, Z amount of money pumped into it because of we want to have VAR at Premier League grounds. But everyone else has to suffer and hope that the decisions are made correctly by the on-field referees, which hopefully more often than not are correct. But how can that be fair, that a competition that is meant to be for everyone really only helps certain teams and grounds with the right decisions being made?
Although it helps both the teams that are in those grounds.
Yeah, so even if it but is it's still a small ground. Handful that it's helping.
It's not perfect. In an ideal world, you'd have it in every ground or you don't have it at all. I mean, I've gone on a journey with VAR. There was a stage earlier in the season where I thought, you just completely scrap this. But it's not happening. So we need to kind of fine-tune VAR in its operation. But if it's there to use, then use it.
It would have been a beautiful opportunity to just revert to football without VAR, wouldn't it? I mean, there is something very retro about the FA Cup anyway. It's supposed to be. Whenever anyone puts together any montage to get you in the mood for the FA Cup, it's always grainy black and white and muddy pitches. And that would have been lovely, I think, to have had a VAR-free zone on the basis of democracy. Mm. The fact that if two League Two teams are facing each other, if VAR is being used, but it's not being used at a non-glamour fixture, there will have been a sense of patronising. Well, that was clearly offside, but there was no VAR, so that's all right, boys. It didn't feel right. You have to be able to sneer at it happening at Anfield and happening.
You need to be able to sneer across the board.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned we're going to talk about the future of the FA Cup. Nuno Espirito Santo and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer have said they would have been happy for their goalless FA Cup tie to go straight to a penalty shootout instead of adding another game. to what is an already crowded fixture schedule. The third round replay at Old Trafford takes place on either the 14th or 15th of January, which will be Wolves' 38th game of the season that began way back in July. United haven't played as many matches, but with a two-legged Carabao Cup semi-final against Manchester City this month, they will play a minimum of 53 games this term and possibly quite a few more, given, like Wolves, they are still in the Europa League. Now, the FA Trophy, the National Cup competition for non-league sides, have the option of playing a single tie to a finish. That is, if both clubs agree in advance, rather than the match going to a replay, although extra time is played before ties go to a penalty, the two clubs can actually decide before kickoff how the first match should end. This option obviously doesn't exist in the FA Cup, but to help those small handful of clubs that are annoyed about their fixture pile-up, should we be adopting a similar system?
No, if they're that blooming annoyed about playing so many games, then lose on purpose. I mean, seriously.
Yes, well,
You play a lot of matches because you're successful. If Wolves didn't want to be in the Europa League, they could quite easily have solved that by not qualifying for it. They want to be there. It's great for the fans. It's great for the club. It's great for reigniting the history of a very fine club. So embrace it. FA Cup, similarly. If you really don't care that much about its traditions, and I think the replay element of the FA Cup is part of its appeal, actually. It's what makes it different, that
replay is like a win sometimes.
It will have certainly felt like that for Tranmere.
Big windfall for a lot of clubs. It also gives a single cup tie a completely different texture. I mean, that in itself is fascinating, isn't it? How the way you have to reorganise if you're a Premier League club and then you're suddenly having to host the underdogs. What do you do? I mean, do you completely change your philosophy from the first time you played them, or do you feel slightly embarrassed and put out a really strong team? It's fascinating the way a replay will change the texture. And if you really, really are that worried about what it means to your fixture list, then, you know, just go for it. Go for it big time in the last 15 minutes. And if that means you're exposed on the counter-attack and you lose, then isn't that a win-win for you? Because no one can say you weren't trying because you were really going for it. You're either going to win it or you're going to be caught on the break. It's their own fault. It really is their own fault. I have no sympathy at all. I love replays. It's very, very important. And yes, it's annoying for a manager of a big club who's busy because it's partially successful. You can't really say Man United are hugely successful at the moment. But it would take away so much for the, you know, you go around the fans of the lower division sides and they dream of getting a replay at a big ground. They want to travel there. They want to see it. They want to have a look at VAR in action, and the club gets money.
But, I mean, tell us, Gregor, is this just managers that think this, or do players also think sometimes, oh, I don't want this replay?
Maybe the elite players. I was never an elite player on TV, completely honest about that. So, although I suppose if I was playing for a championship club and we got a replay against a non-league team or whatever, you probably are thinking, God. But that's part of the cover. I completely agree with Alison. Mm. And to look at the question was about the FA Trophy system, you think, you know, there might be some merit in that, because obviously Rochdale would say no to Newcastle. But I don't know, I'm cynical about whether that would be the thin end of the wedge and you sort of, it would just be the first step towards getting rid of them all. And also, if a Rochdale turns down a Newcastle, then it's not really going to build a great friendship between the two clubs. Or say Liverpool in this fixture build-up period, I'd pulled out a minnow and they said, no, you're not, you know, Liverpool wouldn't be best pleased. They would have wanted to get over and done with in one game. So there's a lot of things to think about there. But the most important thing is the game is not about appeasing, this, as we said, a small, like a handful of elite football clubs. The FA Cup is about every team in the country being able to enter and progress to the next round. And if they get a replay and they get a second chance to do it, that's part of it. So, absolutely not. I think it's keep the replays.
Keep the replays and keep the power to the masses rather
power to the people.
There you go. Tottenham's first game since Harry Kane's hamstring injury saw them taken to a third-round replay by Middlesbrough after Ashley Fletcher's strike was cancelled out by Kane's replacement, Lucas Moura, which will see the sides meet again in London. As Martin Hardy writes in the game today, life without Kane proves hard to watch for Mourinho. It is no secret that Mourinho has always favoured the target man. He won the title with Didier Drogba and Diego Costa in the role. He brought in Zlatan Ibrahimovic and Romelu Lukaku at Manchester United. So without Kane, his tactics don't exactly seem to fit with the replacements of Moura and Son. They have been successful, we know this, without Kane in the past, once winning 8 consecutive games across 2 seasons when he was unavailable. But Kane's absence is likely to prove a much bigger problem for Mourinho than perhaps it did for Maurizio Pochettino. Should Spurs fans be worried, Alison?
Yes, because I think the best option of a target man is Michel Vorm for Spurs, and I don't think he's very good at it. They should be worried because this is really going to test Mourinho adaptability. You've very neatly summed up his career, Natalie, and you know he did promise he was a bit more enlightened now and can't be pigeonholed. I would say a reasonably average manager should be able to get goals out of Son and Moura. Son has always stepped up when Harry Kane has been out of action, to the point that when Pochettino was asked questions rather cheekily, he would be asked, actually, Poch, Spurs are more productive when Harry Kane's out of the team. He would go quite livid and say, well, that's just an anomaly. It's an anomaly. It doesn't mean anything. Well, it does mean something. It does mean that Son does feel the weight of responsibility and does rise to the challenge when the talisman striker is out. So it's up to Mourinho to be able to replicate that. Son is, if anything, a better player than he was 1 year ago and 2 years ago. Forget the little red card blips. He's a scintillating player. And you, as the manager, have to be able to look at what he did previously when Kane was out, what the team did previously when Kane was out, and make it work. Because the ingredients are there. It's definitely doable. But if we're going to see Mourinho just moan about what he hasn't got and what he wish he had got, and this is not what he's used to having, then they'll be in trouble, I think.
Well, it's a hamstring problem, isn't it? And they've got some big games coming up in the next 6 weeks. Liverpool, Manchester City, Chelsea, first leg of their Champions League clash as well with RB Leipzig. It's going to be interesting to see how Jose Mourinho handles that.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable that Tottenham don't have another recognised first-team striker. Like, it's pretty astonishing, really, when you think about it. I mentioned the other week that Llorente was kind of, the fans would get on his back a little bit, or kind of, he'd figure a ridicule because he'd never scored any goals, but he was a great kind of backup option. And they let him go without bringing in anyone else. So, but like Alison said, that, you know, Pochettino did manage to sort of, I think their goals per game ratio rose when Kane was out of the team last season, and the win percentage was about the same. So he, but the style of play has changed dramatically. You know, there's Spurs play far more long balls now, and when you don't have Harry Kane, that's going to be much more difficult. So he's going to have to find a way to play that works to Tottenham's strengths a little bit more with Harry Kane out of the team. So it's got to be sawn through the middle and the ball on the floor a little bit more. That sounds pretty basic and simple, but I can't really see how it's much different.
You're mentioning there about a new promise to Jose Mourinho that he suggested after he left Manchester United. He was going to be a changed man. Is he a changed man when he claims that the ball used in Tottenham's 1-1 draw with Middlesbrough was not up to standard? He said this, "I think this ball is a beach ball. It's too light. I don't think it helps the players. But that's not an excuse." The £115 match ball is used in all FA Cup fixtures this season. It's been designed to manipulate airflow for pinpoint accuracy and superior speed. Does he have a point? Or is this just the worst excuse we've heard from a manager?
Well, some managers have had actual beach balls as excuses, but I have played in matches where they've launched these new balls that have new supersonic this and stitching that just, they're just footballs, aren't they? I mean, it's ridiculous. they are just footballs. And yes, the ball is slightly different in the FA Cup. Slightly different.
I think it's the same as the Football League one, though. So
it's a proper football. It's just slightly different to the Premier League football.
Well, I have to say, I played a season and a half in the National League, and that was a different football. You could tell this was made by a brand which was slightly less recognisable. And honestly, it was like when you played in the FA Cup, you thought, oh, we've got the real balls back. So you can notice differences, although I would imagine the player would be better placed to point this out than Jose Mourinho, the manager, who didn't kick it. So, you know, there can be little sort of variations between the footballs, but we're not playing with a beach ball here at all.
Stupid question then. Knowing this, I don't know if it is stupid or not, but knowing that they're going to have a different ball to play with in the FA Cup, would they have trained?
They'll train with it through the week, yeah.
Yeah, so they will have been well adapted to this ball.
Absolutely.
There will have been probably one cross or one shot which the player felt came off slightly weirdly, which can happen anyway. Mm. And he's just focused on
that.
But yeah, he's I don't think he can help it sometimes. I just think
the real Josie's back.
He has deflection running through his veins.
Yes. This is classic Mourinho deflection then. Okay, to another cup game then, and one striker costs £40 million, the other is 40 years old. Yet it was the journeyman, Aaron Wilbraham, who clinched a deserved replay for League One Rochdale after club record signing Joe Linton again flopped for Newcastle. And tucking away an equaliser 11 minutes from time, Wilbraham scored for the fourth decade in a row, his first goal having come for Stockport County back in 1998. So that means he is the first player to score in four different decades. Quite incredible. His manager, Brian Barry Murphy, reveals he was playing in the memory of his mother, who sadly passed away at the beginning of December. After the game, his manager gave insight into what managing 40-year-old Wilbraham is like.
Amazing. He told me all week he should have been starting. I know he'd tell me all week I got the team wrong, but he's just an inspirational guy and lost his mum recently to a very bad illness. So he's still very much playing in our memory and doing her honour. And he's an amazing guy.
Just a year difference between Wilbraham and Barry Murphy. Gregor, I understand you played against him. What was he like to play against?
Yeah, I'd imagine much the same. He's one of those players who was never the quickest. So kind of, you know, Terry Sherring would be the easy example to use of someone who didn't rely on pace but was intelligent, good at finding space, and usually took his chances when they came along. So he was a good player. He was playing for MK Dons at that time when Paul Ince was the manager and they were sort of on the rise from League Two. And he has got better with age. The best years of his career have come in his 30s. He moved to Norwich and reached the Premier League, Crystal Palace, Bristol City, Bolton, and now Rochdale. So, and, you know, beforehand he was playing for Stockport County and MK Dons. So it's a great story, and I don't envy him. I mean, there's no way I could be playing at 40 years old.
No, surely you could be.
No, I mean, I couldn't imagine. My body felt like it was 40 when I was 28. So you must have some good genes as well.
But it is funny when you see his name. I mean, I remember playing for MK Dons and I had to do a double take of, that's Aaron Wilbraham. Yeah. He's still playing. It's an incredible story. Is it the best story then of the weekend's FA Cup action, Alison, do you think?
Of course it is, because it's about his mum.
I know. It's lovely, isn't it?
It's really nice. And he talked about her driving him in a battered brown Fiesta and they could only afford £2.50 in petrol money. And when you hear detail like that, it makes you realise a lot of players wouldn't be playing if they didn't have a parent who is prepared to just go that little bit further than a lot of parents do. It's like in any sport, the people who reach the top are not the best in the world. They're the ones who had the encouragement from those around them to get them to the places they needed to be in order to win things. So he's acknowledging that if his mum, a single parent, you know, how many single parents with money issues would say, look, we just can't afford, I haven't got the time, I haven't got the energy, we don't have the money for this. But she chose to scrape together what she could to make sure he got to training. I think it's a lovely story.
And also he could have been the parent of the guy who crossed the ball in for him. He's 23 years younger. Luke Matheson is 17.
So, oh my goodness.
Apparently his teammates call him Peter Pan as well because he just keeps going on his chest. So, yeah, that's a great story, yeah.
Well, we mentioned 40-year-old Wilbraham and we also mentioned a £40 million striker. Before the game, Steve Bruce had spoken of the heavy load placed on Joe Linton wearing the Newcastle number 9 shirt. Martin Hardy in the game today says this: the Brazilian looked as though he was carrying 3 sacks of coal as he trooped back to the away dressing room, having been outshone by the 40-year-old Aaron Wilbraham and experienced the Newcastle support turning against him for the first time. His name had been called out for a random drug test. When he arrived in the summer for a club record fee of £40 million, no one said there would be days like Saturday for a striker who has scored 1 goal in 22 games. Can we really put his form down to the weight of the shirt? Is there really such a thing as that, the pressure of a shirt?
I think there can be, but I don't think that's true in this case. I think he's arriving in a new country, in a new league. But most of all, he's playing for Newcastle. You know, I think back to the game against Spurs when he scored his only goal and he led the line really well on his own. But it was a thankless task, and it often is playing for this Newcastle team. And even those around him, he's got Almiron and Sam Maximan often, although he's injured. And no Matt Ritchie, who's the guy who's throwing the crosses in the box. I think he returned this weekend, but he's been out for a long time. So it's been tough. It's tough to play, tough to be the lone centre forward in that team. And, you know, Rondon did it really well last year, but he was always banging headers in from a Matt Ritchie cross, and there's not really been any service for him this year. So I have a little bit of sympathy for him. I think anyone would find it hard in Newcastle's team at the moment.
I mean, Alison, we've talked previously about the weight of expectation when a striker comes in for a big amount of money. Can you understand that? Can players actually feel that pressure?
Of course they can, but it is more about adapting to new environment. And I think most interviews with players who come from abroad when they're already established or already thought of as very promising indeed come to the Premier League, and they come knowing in theory about it, and they love the idea about the way the grounds are geographically built and the intimacy and the passion and the pace, and they hear about all this, but I think playing in it is quite different. It isn't really like anywhere else, they'll say. And some players just have that innate ability to adapt within weeks or a few months. They just have that ability to just morph into it, chameleon-like. They know how to do that. But some players who are very technical, perhaps, or have been brought up ingrained in a particular style with a particular type of coaching and style of play, there's too much for them to process, too many changes and differences for them to process. And once you intellectually acknowledge there's a lot to process, I think that can paralyse you as a player. Because playing football is all about freedom of expression. You're not supposed to think while you're playing. You go into the zone of knowing what you're doing without knowing you're doing it. You make a run, not because you calculate it knowingly, you just instinctively know, and you know what your teammates are capable of, and it gels beautifully. That's what's supposed to happen. But if you're stood there and you're aware that this still feels alien to you, and the noises are alien, and the instructions you've been given are still feeling a little alien, and you haven't clicked early, so you're feeling self-conscious probably, it doesn't matter how gifted you are as a player or how many goals you scored in another league in another country. It'll feel like starting from scratch. And as soon as you have self-doubt in any realm of life, you're not going to be very good at what you do. So it is hard. And now he's heard the boos. I mean, that's going to set him back another few months, isn't it?
I don't think it helps either that he's, you know, Rafa, I think Rafa Benitez turned down the chance to sign. He didn't want to sign him. So he's almost a symbol of Rafa's departure, the ownership and the sort of acrimony that supporters feel towards that. He's almost the symbol of it. And well, they, you know, there was a lot of goodwill. They wanted to spend £40 million on a centre forward. This is good news. But still, the longer it goes on, he kind of becomes a symbol of what they left behind and what they've got now, and the sort of their distaste of the owners. So I do feel for him. But I think, as I said, the most important thing is he's playing in a team it's just not set up to score many goals. Centre halves are scoring a lot from corners, but they're not really sort of a coherent attacking unit at all.
Does that mean that the future doesn't bode very well for him?
I think he needs, you know, there's not even really anyone else to put in and for him to have a little breakout of the team either. That's the other thing for him. So I think it also depends on how the two players around him do, because the front three is that front three, none of them have really settled very well yet. So I think it kind of, he needs better service as well.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guest today, Alison Rudd.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Thursday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.